my board volunteers for AFA that they're going to walk away from that experience being able to carry a best practice to the PTA or carry the best practice to their kids' little league. And I think that's the value add for being in an association is how do you take the learning that you get in one place and carry it on to make another place better?
Hi, I'm Christine Shaw, CEO and President of Naylor Association Solutions, and I'm your host of the Association Advisor Podcast. We'll learn from successful association executives, partners, and clients on how to create a thriving, prosperous, and value-driven association. I invite you to join me in keeping informed and, most importantly, keeping your association profitable. Our goal is to leave you feeling inspired, more confident, and more knowledgeable. This is the Association Advisor Podcast.
Hi, and welcome back to the Association Advisor Podcast, brought to you by Naylor Association Solutions. I'm your host, Christine Shaw. Today, we're diving into how associations can thrive with both visionary leadership and practical strategies. Joining us for this topic is Michael Reed, Executive Director of the American Fence Association. Under Michael's leadership, AFA works to make the world a safer and more beautiful place. Michael has over 25 years of experience working with associations and has used innovative approaches to education, technology, and strategic planning. We'll discuss Michael's leadership philosophy, which is partly inspired by his doctoral research on trust and board governance. He'll tell us about the steps he takes to enhance member experience and why he prioritizes leadership development opportunities. It's going to be a fascinating conversation, so let's get started. Michael, welcome to the Association Advisor Podcast. I'm so happy to have you join us today.
Well, thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
What I would love to do is start out by you telling our listeners all about your journey into association leadership.
My story is very similar to a lot of folks. I did not know what I was doing at the time was association management. So my first job after I graduated from college was to work for my fraternity. And so I traveled all across the United States, well, specifically in the Northeast, working with chapter leaders on growth, working with chapter leaders on leadership development, working with chapter leaders on how to live an organization that's consistent with your values and your mission. And that led into an association management career. I've also started two businesses, but those two businesses were all association related. So I started a back office solution provider for associations, and we created a piece of software before AMSs were AMSs. We created a piece of software and partnered with Kiwanis International to provide management to clubs. And then the second business I started with a business partner was a consultancy. And so, but all my clients were associations. And so my whole entire career, with the exception of two brief stints outside, has all been association related.
That's amazing. So, you know, a lot of leaders like you don't start off in the space, but then once they're in the space, they really develop their journey throughout that. So that's amazing to see. And just a little fun fact. So my son was a huge into fraternity Greek life, going to college as an engineer. And I'll tell you, a lot of people have a wrong idea about fraternities, but it shaped a lot of who he is today, both professionally and personally, all in a very good way. So, but here you are as the leader. This is fantastic. So in terms of your current position under your leadership, the AFA has been revamping and increasing educational offerings for members. So tell us a little bit about the mission of AFA and how this supports the mission.
So one of the core tenets of our mission is professional development. So it's kind of why people come to the organization. So it's a pretty natural thing. I think what we try to foster is a sense of belonging. And so it's a very tight-knit community. The fence industry as a trade organization made up of both the suppliers and the installers of fences. And so we try to foster a very strong community sense of belonging. And then what people find when they join is their first consumable is probably something in the education realm. So we have professional development, and our professional development is broadly based in three areas. So we do technical education, and then we do business education. And then since I've been here, we've put a special emphasis on leadership education. And so those are the three things. And then In terms of what happens next is that once people kind of get in and they participate in an education program, then they find a leadership role. And so they belong to a special interest group, or they belong to a chapter, or they get involved in a committee or task force work. And so if you think about that engagement model, we're pretty traditional in that people come to us, they have probably a learning need, and then once that learning need is fulfilled, they participate in other things in the organization. So the idea is they put enough education together and that helps them grow their business, and then they're happy and we're happy.
You know, what I love about that, Michael, is that you hit on the two core things that are so important. One is sense of belonging. And associations are so good at building community, particularly community aligned around a purpose and a mission, as you articulated. But professional development is so key to the success of not just the individuals, but the companies that they work for and go on to do work with. That professional development is so paramount to the success of the association. So kudos to you as an executive director and AFA for making those some of the tenets of the association's purpose.
One of the things that's interesting about our business is that we have a lot of folks who maybe they graduated from high school, maybe they didn't. And then we work a lot with standards writing organizations and those folks who are engineers and are highly educated, maybe and hold a professional engineering license. And so when you talk about professional development across all of our constituencies, we run the gamut from folks who may not have had a lot of success in the classroom to folks who are, you know, hold professional licenses and expertise in their particular area. And I think that one of those things, and that's kind of one of the strengths of the organization, is that fabric gets woven together between folks who may have struggled through the classroom, but still want to be able to learn things to grow their businesses, and folks who have a lot of technical expertise coming together to kind of make things better for the industry. It's one of the most unique experiences that I ever experienced, either as an association employee or as a consultant. It's very unique.
Yeah, and you're so right, because there's almost a resurgence coming about trade jobs where that it's the working hand. However, and a lot of those people went to either trade schools or didn't go and complete the education formal process. However, technology and business acumen still is what drives a lot of innovation in these industries. And so I love that professional development, because not only does it give them the skills that they might not have gotten in the trade, but it gives them the confidence to work with groups and to take their businesses and their learnings to the next level. So that's fantastic.
Now, a lot of these folks, there's professional certification that they've earned from us is something that they highlight as part of their, when they say I'm a fence professional or I belong to the fence industry and I'm a leader in this industry, a lot of these folks hold on to their professional credentials very closely and very proudly.
I love that. You're empowering a lot of success by doing that. And speaking of innovation and things, the most talked about technology right now is AI. So tell us a little bit about how you've begun to integrate AI to help improve the learning and credentialing process you just discussed.
So this is the value, I think, of having a professional network. Is so as part of me being a volunteer with AMCI, I met a gentleman by the name of Dan Streeter at Mission Fuel. And Dan has a consultancy that focuses on helping organizations leverage AI. And he's got a great professional development background, instructional design background. And so specifically how we've used AI is to go back through our professional development offerings and do some of that groundwork that wasn't done when these courses were originally created. So we go back and look at it from an instructional design process and use AI to then help build out learning objectives, to look out how the course map will go. We create a series of career pathways and filled in the blanks on how somebody might have a career in the fence industry along three different pathways. And all of that was enhanced by doing that first draft with AI and then letting subject matter experts go through and refine that and make it complete. And we could have never done as much as we've accomplished in the last year on that without leveraging AI to make that happen. And I think it's one thing for somebody to use prompts to create marketing materials or to create blog posts or the way that a lot of people use AI right now in kind of its infancy. But it's a whole nother thing to have an expert who can help you with the instructional design prompts that are necessary for you to go from course concept to learning objectives to that fits within a course map, all the way through workbook exercises and the creation of workbooks. And while not all of our courses needed that, it was, we needed a workbook here, we needed learning objectives here, we needed, but what we were able to do is create an entire curriculum map across three different career pathways, all by using AI.
That's amazing.
And we were able to do it very quickly. It's worked out well.
I'm glad you shared that, because you're right that there's a lot of companies and people using it at the infancy level, right? But what you're seeing, I just attended a conference last week, a leadership conference, where companies are really using now AI in practical applications for things like you just described. And let's face it, we're in a world where most of us don't get more resources in the budget cycle. So it's what can you do? And this technology is just game changing for a lot of people and organizations. So that's a great use case of AI. One of the best ones I've heard of.
Let me give you one very practical example for anybody who's coming out of the credentialing space. When I ran credentialing programs in the past, we would bring subject matter experts together and we would have this tedious process of writing items. And so we would sit and write exam item after exam item, and people would struggle with them, especially folks maybe, because again, this was a trade organization, so maybe folks weren't completely comfortable writing a structured exam item that had one right answer and two distractors and a clear wrong answer. And so we were able to expedite the creation of exam questions and then let people go in and edit those and even have some basic psychometric tenets for those questions. And somebody could go back and say, well, you know what? I don't think that 70% of the people, average people, will get this correct. I think that it's probably closer to 85%. And then to have that discussion around subject matter experts, again, you're talking about the ability to have, you know, use AI to create items that people can go in and edit rather than sit there and struggle to create. It changes the entire way that we're looking at how we credential people. And then one of the outcomes from that is that now we're going to be able to offer test prep chatbots so people can go in and create their own custom chatbot series, whatever exam that they were going to take. And it's based on the items that are already in the bank, but it's all brand new questions. It's amazing what we've been able to do using artificial intelligence.
Yeah. So let me just ask you about that. Do you have an individual who spearheads this, or do you have a steering committee internally? Like, who manages all the AI initiatives for you?
So I have both a staff person on the professional development side and on the credentialing side. So their duties are split. And then, as I mentioned, Dan Streeter from Mission Fuel has been the subject matter expert, the instructional design and AI expert that we've been in. And it's really a fascinating process to watch, because the staff person, with their knowledge of content, will kind of guide how the prompts go. Dan will actually articulate what the prompts are. AI kind of does its work, and then people refine it. And then it's that finished product that goes out to the industry subject matter experts to then further refine.
Unbelievable. Wow, this is like a great case study. I'm glad you shared it. And it's a call to action for all of us to really think outside the box of, if you can use it in this application, like, you have to think about internally what things you could do with it. So that's great.
I think it's what you said earlier. It's how do you leverage the resources that you have more effectively? And I think we were able to allocate some financial resources to get some outside consulting. And that outside consulting then allowed our internal resources to really get done what they needed.
Yeah. You know, the important aspect of that is as we go into 2025 as leaders and think about what objectives do we have, how do you use AI to enhance the talent you have? And it changes the discussion from being threatening, intimidating, to added, and how can you do more with AI with the team you have? And if we can change our narrative and our thought process around that, we can, I believe, have much stronger outcomes for what each organization can do.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I'll be honest with you. I never thought of it until I read things online where people were thinking about how this might replace folks on your staff or replace resources that you're allocating. And I just never had that orientation until I read it. And that's not how it works, because, you know, it's not an expert. You still need the experts, either the association experts or the content experts, to still make it what it needs to be. What it does is it expedites the process and allows you to really get done more things that you would have struggled through manage if you were managing that process with just your volunteer subject matter experts.
Well, staying on the educational track, in addition to your leadership role at AFA, you're pursuing a doctoral research focus project on trust and board governance. So tell us a little bit about that academic research and how it informs your current approach to leadership. It's very impressive, Michael, by the way.
It sounds more impressive than it is. This was a lifelong goal, was to earn a doctorate degree. And whoever thought it was a good idea to go back in your 50s to school and get a doctorate degree, that was crazy. That was not a good idea.
Yeah.
So the last piece of it is to finish my doctoral research. And it's interesting because I have a whole series of excuses on why it's not done yet, but I'm slowly chipping away at it. And it's this idea that I came up with as a consultant, and I would be working with groups. And the idea was, if things were going well for that organization, they would go, well, it's because we have a lot of trust here at the board. But inevitably, especially when you're calling in an outside organizational development consultant, things weren't going well. And so one of the questions inevitably would be, well, why aren't things going well? And people would say, well, it's just because we don't have a lot of trust. So I became intrigued with the question of what was the impact or what was the role of trust in organizations, especially as it pertains to governance, board leadership. And I really struggled because if you look at governance as a concept, it's giant. And then if you look at trust as a concept, it's giant. But I finally have narrowed it down to kind of looking at two different things. And one is that role of interpersonal trust, or how do people get along with one another from looking at through a trust lens. And then this idea of what behaviors can you do better as a result of being in a high trust environment? So if you've got a board that's high trust, do you deliberate more effectively? Do you communicate more effectively? Are you more open? Or do you use better use of time? So all of those things that we know to be important to good governance, you know, are you able to think more strategically? Are you able to articulate a generative look at the future? And then do you take your fiduciary responsibilities more to heart? Or are you just better at being a fiduciary for your organization as a result of being in a high or low trust environment? So, like I said, it sounds way better and way more interesting than the truth of it is, but it's all based on just walking into organizations and them saying, well, we've got a high trust organization, so we operate really effectively in this area or not.
You know, it's interesting you say that, and it's so topical because literally the conference I was at with a lot of leaders from all kinds of companies, billion-dollar companies, the number one factor to success is having trust. And that leads into my next question, which is culture, right? So the way to have a strong culture is trust is one of the top most important things. So let's talk a little bit about that. And what is some of your philosophies around creating a positive, productive culture? It sounds like trust is important from what you're learning and what you believe, but tell us a little bit more about your culture.
So if you look at trust, if you were to define trust and I were to define trust, it might sound very different when we wrote it down on a piece of paper. But there are some things that engender greater trust or trustworthiness. And three of the things that I try to instill on our team is kind of first, this idea of assuming positive intent. A lot of times working with volunteers, working with our teammates, we don't always assume positive intent. We get the idea in our mind that a difficult volunteer is just being difficult for the sake of it, or a team member is not pulling their weight just for the sake of it. And I think that that first idea of creating a trusting environment is to come into it thinking that, you know what, at the end of the day, most people are here for good intent, and using that as the first. And then the second piece of this is this idea of practice blameless problem solving. We work in a really difficult environment in that our workforce is made up of volunteers and it's made up of paid staff, and they all have varying degrees of expertise in association management. Sometimes they've volunteered for years in their organization. But this idea of practice blameless problem solving is when things go wrong, we focus on what the solution of the issue is, not going back and finger pointing.
Whose fault it is, yeah.
Whose fault it is. And the last part is this kind of generic, you know, checking your ego at the door. This whole idea that this ultimately isn't about, you know, a volunteer leader. It's not about me as the executive director or staff person who's responsible for that particular function. It really is ultimately about the member, which ties you back to the organization's purpose and North Star and so on and so forth. So I think those three things, that idea, assuming positive intent and practice blameless problem solving and checking your ego at the door, are all elements. Those are all things that you can reinforce. And when people do those things, kind of cheer them on and aspirationally strive to meet those things. And it's taken 3 years, but now I'll have a volunteer call on the phone and they'll say, you know, I'm really trying to practice blameless problem solving here, but we still have this issue. And there's still accountability in place. It's just because you're practicing blameless problem solving doesn't mean that you don't still have accountability issues. If you do those three things and you can start to build trust and trustworthiness on the team, when I say team, I mean that volunteer leadership and staff-driven team, and then it's just good focus on your strategy execution. I think that's the key to at least starting a building a trusting environment.
Yeah, you know, I actually took notes and wrote those three things down because I agree that you can all have different interpretations of what trust means, but you really boiled it down to three key things that do happen. And, you know, I've been in many meetings where there's almost an accusatory tone. The blame game, it's just awful watching people go, well, it's their fault. And it's like, I love that. You know, the other thing too is that whole accountability. Michael, I was just at that conference, we had a keynote, which was John Foley, who's a Blue Angel. And, you know, they let us inside their briefing room. And what they do is after every exercise, they do a debrief. And each team member has to say what mistakes they made and how they're going to fix it and how brilliant, like walk into the room and just, you know, be your own critic. So I love that. This is great.
The Army calls that I don't know what the Navy calls it, but the Army calls that an after action review. And it's actually one of the elements that we've started to talk about that's been missing after our project execution, of where we have to go back and say, what did we learn from this? What did we do well? What did we not do as well as we thought? And so as we look at our 2025 strategy execution, we're actually looking at building into our processes that after action review, similar to what you described.
Which speaks to your third point of check your ego, because they said, if you want to talk about egos, put a bunch of fighter pilots in a room,
exactly.
Right?
Yep.
You don't get any more ego than that. And they're like, it's a humble process, but it works. So I love it. This is great. Yep. But that really leads into, without trust and all the things you describe, you can't really have an effective strategy or execution. So talk a little bit about how do you go from, you know, what's your process like every year? We're about to embark on 2025. I'm sure your planning's well underway. So talk to us a little bit about that.
Consulting for 9 years was such a valuable experience because I really struggled with my association clients. And so I ended up coming up with a different way of looking at strategy. And I kind of broke it into three parts for groups. And what the first was kind of the strategic thinking, or kind of the idea of what might be possible, this generative thinking that we talk about when we talk about governance, skating to where the puck's going to be, this idea of what's going to happen in the future, what's the impact of current trends. That idea of strategic thinking is much different than strategic planning. And what I learned over the years was that people were really good at strategic thinking. And then the problem is the strategic planning piece is the tough decisions about what you do and don't do. So my approach to strategic planning, especially this year, was just going back and saying, are we still playing where we want to play? Do we still have how we define how we're going to win in this particular space? So this idea of strategic thinking is just about making those tough choices about what you're going to do and not do, and then coming up with a framework for strategy implementation. We happen to use objectives and key results, but there's lots of different ways that people do strategy implementation, and it depends on kind of the leader's comfortableness of implementing that framework. But there's lots of frameworks for strategy implementation, but that's different than the actual planning process, which is different than the actual thinking process. So in our case, we looked around the room to the board and said, are we still thumbs up on our direction, on how we're successful in each of our functional areas? And they said, yes. And then we went back and said, okay, in terms of our objectives and key results, are we stretching in the right ways? And then it becomes a matter of making sure you have the right resources necessary to implement your plan.
I think you touch on something important, that there's lots of different framework types. So I think part of the key is really being clear on what your framework is and alignment on that organization wide so that there's consistency and continuity. So yeah, that's great.
Well, I think one of the tenets that I firmly believe is that when my board volunteers or a chapter president volunteers for AFA, that they're going to walk away from that experience being able to carry a best practice to the PTA or carry the best practice to their kids' little league or carry a best practice into their Kiwanis Club or their Lions Club, wherever they're active. Because I want people to walk away with that. And I've had people come back and say, man, that's not how we did strategic planning, but I was able to tell them how we did it, and it was really helpful. And I think that's the value add for being in an association is, how do you take the learning that you get in one place and carry it on to make another place better?
Yeah, and I'll tell you what, Michael, I started as a young girl in 4-H. I was president of my 4-H club for years. It's amazing that all these years later as a leader CEO, how many times you reflect back on the fundamentals you learn through that type of work. So, and how transferable those skills are throughout your life.
I will laughingly say that a lot of the things that I was doing as a 23-year-old leadership consultant for my fraternity, traveling all over the Northeast from campus to campus, is pretty much what I'm doing now. Not exactly. And it's a little bit, the stakes are a little bit higher when you're talking about people's businesses, but the same struggles that we had back then of inspiring leaders and helping people grow their businesses and getting people excited about the mission of the organization and not just about the social aspects of the organization, those are all the same.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more. Well, I know you've shared that you don't have a full strategy update due. However, you must have some exciting initiatives or goals for the AFA this coming year. Anything you care to share or willing to share?
Sure. We have several major initiatives that are continuing to grow. So our whole credentialing initiative and professional development initiatives, this whole career pathways that I was talking about, or the updating of all our credential programs, those are kind of being extended. But one of the things that we have are new this year is that I had a task force come together under the inspiration of one of our key volunteers, and they created a Net Promoter Score, an NPS tool for our industry, where our members will be able to go out and get feedback from their customers and make their businesses better.
I love that.
And what's cool about it is that it becomes a source of non-dues revenue, but we're able to build an entire education around customer engagement, improving operations, everything that we get back from putting a tool into the hands of our members. And for many years, the race to relevancy was, how do you create an association that is relevant to your members? And this was one of the ways that we answered that, is by being able to develop this piece of software that allows people to collect information from their members and then benchmark it from the other people in the industry. So we've created a whole, going back to that culture of accountability or the data that is collected, we've built the Net Promoter Score process into how we're engaging all of our stakeholders. So we're engaging our instructors. What was their Net Promoter Score? We're engaging our students. What was their Net Promoter Score? We're engaging our volunteers. What was their experience as board members, as committee members, you know, being on the nominations committee? And we're taking all of that data and using that to kind of further this idea that getting member feedback helps you get better.
And tell me how that ties into the non-dues revenue you touched upon, that.
Because this software that they're going to buy, they're going to pay for. They'll have a subscription. It'll be built on the software subscription model, and they'll participate in that, and they'll be able to solicit feedback from their customers and then use that data to improve their businesses. And then I'll get all of the data, and all of that data we'll use to benchmark who's got the best Net Promoter Scores in each particular region or each particular chapter. So that's how we'll build this idea of getting better using data.
Awesome. I love it. This episode has been full of such great advice. So Michael, the last question we ask is recommended reading. So I have to believe with the bookcase behind you full of books, as well as all your academic research, you must have some good recommendations. So let's hear it.
I'm a fan of this idea of data and how we use strategy implementation. So I think my recommendation for reading that I actually keep on my desk is Measure What Matters by John Doerr. And it's all how to use the objectives and key results. So how Intel used it, how Google used it, how the Bono Foundation used it. And so there's just a really good explanation. And from a leadership perspective, I just finished reading Modern Achievement. That was a really good, it's actually brand new. It's kind of written for the next generation of leaders, and it's full of very practical advice. And I took a lot of notes on, hey, I'm really not hitting this really as well as I could be.
Wow. Who's the author of that book, Modern Achievement?
So that is Ashish Andavi and Marshall Goetzman.
Yep, I love that. This is a good time of year to do that.
It is. And one of the wonderful things about OKRs is that they can be adjusted. And so for 2 years, the last 2 years, we've used kind of a simplified version of OKRs. And our board came back this year and said, we need the key results to be much more quantitative. So we made them much more quantitative. And we were using a red, yellow, green stoplight for whether things, you know, how confident we are that we were going to hit that. And they said, no, come back with a numerical number now. So what's nice is the board actually has now bought into it. And I will say it did not happen easily, but we were at our staff retreat last week. And one of my staff folks came up to me and said, you know, when we first started doing these, I was not a fan. I did not like how we're doing this. We had done a lot of work over the previous day and a half. And he came back and he said, now these are my best friend.
I use the stoplight to project management, et cetera. And one of the things I did a couple of years back in a company I was leading is I put the numerical value and I did conditional formatting in Excel. So what would happen is they'd type in the number and it would pop in that color, which brought it all together in Nirvana. So that was like, I can tell we could geek out about stuff like that all day, but I love that. Well, this has been a great episode. I took a lot of notes. I mean, you gave me some really good things to take away and think about as we approach 2025. So thank you so much for sharing all your knowledge. And we look forward to following more of your work and what you're doing for your association. Well done, Michael. Thank you.
Well, Christine, thank you very much. I appreciate the time and I loved having a conversation.
Excellent. Well, you have a great day.
You too.
Thank you for listening to the Association Advisor Podcast, brought to you by Naylor Association Solutions. If you'd like to access more resources to serve your association needs or join our newsletter, you can visit our website at naylor.com or just click the links in the show notes of this episode. Please be sure to follow us on your favorite podcast listening app, like Spotify, Apple, or wherever you listen to your podcasts, so you won't miss an episode. Also, I'd love to hear from my listeners directly. Feel free to email me at christine.shaw@naylor.com. Until next time, we at Naylor are wishing your association success.